part of the price you paid when you sold your soul for rock and roll? What self-respecting player didn't suffer tinnitus from time to time? Look at Pete Townsend, Eric Clapton, Neil Young. Then, in Oak Park, the vertigo and nausea started. Halfway through their set, Hugh reeled off stage and hurled into a bucket filled with sand. "I still remember the sign and the post above it," he told me. "Use for small fires only." He finished the gig somehow, took his bows, and reeled off stage. "What's wrong with you?" Felix Granby asked. He was the lead guitarist and lead vocalist, which meant to the public at large, the portion of it that rocked, at least, he was Johnson Katz. "Are you drunk?" "Oh, stomach flu," Hugh said. "It's getting better." He thought it was true. With the amps off, the tinnitus did seem to be ebbing. But the next morning it was back, and other than the hellish ringing, he could hear almost nothing. Two members of Johnson Katz fully grasped looming disaster, Felix Granby and Hugh himself. Only 3 days ahead was the Silver Dome in Pontiac, capacity 90,000. With Detroit favorite Bob Seger headlining, it would be almost full. The JC was on the cusp of fame, and in rock and roll, such chances rarely come around a second time. So Felix Granby had done to Hugh what Kelly Van Dorn of White Lightning had done to me. "I bore him no grudge," Hugh said. "If our positions had been reversed, I might have done the same. He hired a session player out of Lamore's studio in Detroit, and it was that guy who went on stage with them that night at the Dome." Granby did the firing in person, not by talking, but by writing notes and holding them up for Hugh to read. He pointed out that while the other members of the JC came from middle-class families, Hugh was from real money. He could fly back to Colorado in a comfy seat at the front of the plane and consult all the best doctors. Granby's last note, written in capital letters, read, "You will be back with us before you know it." "As if," Hugh said as we sat in the shade, eating our sandwiches from Tubby's. "You still miss it, don't you?" I asked. "No." Long pause. "Yes." He did not go back to Colorado. "If I'd have, I sure wouldn't have flown. I had an idea my head might explode once we got above 20,000 feet. Besides, home wasn't what I wanted. All I wanted to do was lick my wounds, which were still bleeding. And Detroit was as good a licking place as any. That's the story I told myself anyway." The symptoms did not abate. Vertigo, nausea ranging from moderate to severe, and always that hellish ringing, sometimes soft, sometimes so loud he thought his head would split open. On occasion, all these symptoms would draw back like a tide going out, and then he would sleep for 10 or even 12 hours at a stretch. Although he could have afforded better, he was living in a fleabag hotel on Grand Avenue. For 2 weeks he put off going to a doctor, terrified that he would be told he had a malignant and inoperable brain tumor. But when he finally did force himself into a dock-in-the-box on Inkster Road, a Hindu medic, who looked about 17, listened, nodded, did a few tests, and urged Hugh to check himself into a hospital for more tests, plus experimental anti-nausea medications he himself could not prescribe. "So sorry." Instead of going to the hospital, Hugh began taking long and pointless safaris, when the vertigo permitted it, that was, up and down the fabled stretch of Detroit Road known as 8 Mile. One day he passed a storefront with radios, guitars, record players, tape decks, amplifiers, and TVs in the dusty window. According to the sign, this was Jacob's New and Used Electronics. Although to Hugh Yates, most of it looked beat to shit and none of it looked new. "I can't tell you exactly why I went in. Maybe it was some creeped-out nostalgia for all that audio candy. Maybe it was self-flagellation. Maybe I just thought the place would be air-conditioned and I could get out of the heat. Boy, was I ever wrong about that. Or maybe it was a sign over the door." "What did it say?" I asked. Hugh smiled at me.
You can trust the Rev.
He was the only customer. The shelves were packed with equipment a lot more exotic than the wares in the window. Some stuff he knew. Meters, oscilloscopes, voltmeters, and voltage regulators, amplitude regulators, rectifiers, power inverters. Other stuff he didn't recognize. Electric cords snaked across the floor and wires were strung everywhere. The proprietor came out through a door framed in blinking Christmas lights.
Probably a bell jingled when I came in, but I sure didn't hear it, Hugh said.
My old fifth business was dressed in faded jeans and a plain white shirt buttoned to the collar. His mouth moved in,
hello,
and something that might have been, can I help you? Hugh tipped him a wave, shook his head, and browsed along the shelves. He picked up a Stratocaster and gave it a strum, wondering if it was in tune. Jacobs watched him with interest, but no detectable concern. Although Hugh's rock dog do now hung in unwashed clumps to his shoulders, and his clothes were equally dirty. After 5 minutes or so, just as he was losing interest and getting ready to walk back to the flea bag where he now hung his hat, the vertigo hit. He reeled, putting out one hand and knocking over a disassembled stereo speaker. He almost recovered, but he hadn't been eating much, and the world turned gray. Before he hit the shop's dusty wooden floor, it had turned black. It was my story all over again. Only the location was different. When he woke up, he was in Jacob's office with a cold cloth on his forehead. Hugh apologized and said he would pay for anything he might have broken. Jacobs drew back, blinking in surprise. This was a reaction Hugh had seen often in the last weeks.
"Sorry if I'm talking too loud," Hugh said. "I can't hear myself. I'm deaf."
Jacobs rummaged a notepad from the top drawer of his cluttered desk. I could imagine that desk, littered with snips of wire and batteries. He jotted and held the pad up. "Recent? I saw you with guitar."
"Recent," Hugh agreed. "I have something called Meniere's disease. I'm a musician."
He considered that and laughed, soundlessly to his own ears, although Jacobs responded with a smile.
"Used to be, anyhow."
Jacobs turned a page in his notebook, wrote briefly, and held it up. "If it's Meniere's, I might be able to do something for you." "Obviously he did," I said. Lunch hour was over. The girls had gone back inside. There was stuff I could be doing, plenty, but I had no intention of leaving until I heard the rest of Hugh's story.
"We sat in his office for a long time. Conversation slow when one person has to write his side of it. I asked him how he thought he could help me. He wrote that just lately he'd been experimenting with transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. TENS, for short. He said the idea of using electricity to stimulate damaged nerves went back thousands of years, that it was invented by some old Roman."
A dusty door far back in my memory opened. An old Roman named Scribonius. He discovered that if a guy with a bad leg stepped on an electric eel, the pain sometimes went away. And that just lately stuff was crap, Hugh. Your Rev was playing around with TENS before it was officially invented. He stared at me, eyebrows up.
"Go on," I said. "Okay, but we'll come back to this, right?" I nodded. "You show me yours, I show you mine." That was the deal. "I'll give you a hint. There's a fainting spell in my story, too." "Well, I told him that Meniere's disease was a mystery. Doctors didn't know if it had to do with the nerves, or if it was a virus causing a chronic buildup of fluid in the middle ear, or some kind of bacterial thing, or maybe genetic. He wrote, 'All diseases are electrical in nature.' I said that was crazy. He just smiled, turned to a new page in his pad, and wrote for a longer time. Then he handed it across to me. I can't quote it exactly. It's been a long time. But I'll never forget the first sentence. Electricity is the basis of all life. That was Jacobs, all right. The line was better than a fingerprint. The rest says something like, take your heart. It runs on microvolts. This current is provided by potassium, an electrolyte. Your body converts potassium into ions, electrically charged particles, and uses them to regulate not just your heart, but your brain and everything else. Those last words were in capitals. He put a circle around them. When I handed his pad back, he drew something on it very quick, then pointed to my eyes, my ears, my chest, my stomach, and my legs. Then he showed me what he'd drawn. It was a lightning bolt. Sure it was. Cut to the chase, Hugh. Well, Hugh said he'd have to think it over. What he didn't say, but was certainly thinking, was that he didn't know Jacobs from Adam. The guy could be one of the crazy birds that flap around every big city. Jacobs wrote that he understood Hugh's hesitation and felt plenty of his own. I'm going out on a limb to even make the offer. After all, I don't know you any more than you know me. Is it dangerous? Hugh asked in a voice that was already losing tone and inflection, becoming robotic. The Rev shrugged and wrote, won't kid you. There's some risk involved in applying electricity directly through the ears. But low voltage, okay? I'd guess the worst side effect you'd suffer might be peeing your pants. This is crazy, Hugh said. We're insane just to be having this discussion. The Rev shrugged again, but this time didn't write, only looked. Hugh sat in the office, the cloth, still damp but now warm, clutched in one hand, seriously considering Jacob's proposal, and a large part of his mind found serious consideration, even on such short acquaintance, perfectly normal. He was a musician who had gone deaf and been cast aside by a band he'd helped to found, one now on the verge of national success. Other players, and at least one great composer, Beethoven, had lived with deafness, but hearing loss wasn't where Hugh's woes ended. There was the vertigo, the trembling, the periodic loss of vision. There was nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, galloping pulse. Worst of all was the almost constant tinnitus. He'd always thought deafness meant silence. This was not true, at least not in his case. Hugh Yates had a constantly braying burglar alarm in the middle of his head. There was another factor, too, a truth not acknowledged until then, but glimpsed from time to time, as if in the corner of the eye. He had remained in Detroit because he was working up his courage. There were many pawn shops on 8 Mile, and all of them sold barrel iron. Was what this guy was offering any worse than the muzzle of a third-hand .38 socked between his teeth and pointing at the roof of his mouth? In his too loud robot's voice, he said, what the fuck? Go ahead. Hugh gazed at the mountains while he told the rest, his right hand stroking his right ear as he spoke. I don't think he knew he was doing it. They put a closed sign in the window, locked the door, and dropped the blinds. Then he sat me down in a kitchen chair by the cash register and put a steel case the size of a footlocker on the counter. Inside it were 2 metal rings wrapped in what looked like gold mesh. They're about the size of those big dangly earrings Georgia wears when she's styling. You know the ones I mean? Sure. There was a rubber widget on the bottom of each with a wire coming out of it. The wires ran into a control box no bigger than a doorbell. He opened the bottom of the box and showed me what looked like a single AAA battery. I relaxed. That can't do much damage, I thought. But I didn't feel quite so comfortable when he put on rubber gloves, you know, like the kind women wear when they're washing dishes, and picked up the rings with tongs. I think Charlie's AAA batteries are different from the ones you buy in the store, I said. A lot more powerful. Didn't he ever talk to you about the secret electricity? Oh, God. Many times. It was his hobby horse. But that was later, and I never made head or tail of it. I'm not sure he did either. He got a look in his eyes. Puzzled, I said. Puzzled, worried, and excited all at the same time. Yeah, like that. He put the rings against my ears, using the tongs, you know, and then asked me to push the button on the control unit, since his own hands were full. I almost didn't, but I flashed in all the pistols and all those pawn shop windows, and I did it. Then blacked out. I didn't ask it as a question, because I was sure of it. But he surprised me. There were blackouts, all right, and what I'd call prismatics, but they came later. Right then, there was just an almighty snapping sound in the middle of my head. My legs shot out, my hands went up over my head like a school kid who's just desperate to tell the teacher he knows the right answer. That brought back memories. Also, there was a taste in my mouth, like I'd been sucking on pennies. I asked Jacob so I could have a drink of water, and heard myself asking, and broke into tears. I cried for quite a while. He held me. At last, Hugh turned from the mountains and looked at me. After that, I would have done anything for him, Jamie. Anything. I know the feeling. When I had control of myself again, he took me back out into the shop and put a pair of Koss headphones on me. He plugged into an FM station and kept turning the music down and asking me if I could hear it. I did, until he got all the way to zero, and I could almost swear I even heard it then. He not only brought my hearing back, it was more acute than it had been since I was 14 and playing with my first jam band. Hugh asked how he could repay Jacobs. The Rev, only a scruffy guy in need of a haircut and a bath, considered this. Tell you what, he said at last. There's little in the way of business here, and some of the people who do wander in are pretty sketchy. I'm going to transport all this stuff to a storage facility on the north side while I think about what to do next. You could help me.
Well, I can do better than that,
Hugh said, still relishing the sound of his own voice. I'll rent the storage space myself and hire a crew to move everything. I don't look like I can afford it, but I can, really. Jacob seemed horrified at the idea. Absolutely not. The goods I have for sale are mostly junk, but my equipment is valuable, and much of it in the back area, my lab, is delicate as well. Your help would be more than enough repayment, although first you need to rest a little and eat. Put on a few pounds. You've been through a difficult time. Would you be interested in becoming my assistant, Mr. Yates?
If that's what you want, Hugh said. Mr. Jacobs, I still can't believe you're talking and I'm hearing you.
In a week, you'll take it for granted, he said dismissively. That's the way it works with miracles. No use railing against it. It's plain old human nature. But since we have shared a miracle in this overlooked corner of the Motor City, I can't have you calling me Mr. Jacobs. To you, let me be the Rev.
As in Reverend?
Exactly, he said and grinned. Reverend Charles D. Jacobs, currently chief prelate in the First Church of Electricity. And I promise not to work you too hard. There's no hurry. We'll take our time.
I'll bet you did, I said.
What's that supposed to mean?
He didn't want you to buy him a moving crew, and he didn't want your money. He wanted your time. I think he was studying you, looking for after effects. What did you think?
Then? Nothing. I was riding a mighty cloud of joy. If the Rev had asked me to rob first of Detroit, I might have given it a shot. Looking back on it, though, you could be right. There wasn't much to the work, after all, because when you came right down to it, he had very little to sell. There was more in his back room, but with a big enough U-Haul, we could have moved the whole kit and caboodle off the 8 Mile in 2 days. But he strung it out over a week.
He considered.
Yeah, okay. He was watching me.
Studying. Looking for after effects. I peeked at my watch. I had to be in the studio in 15 minutes, and if I lingered longer in the picnic area, I was going to be late. Walk me down to Studio One. Tell me what they were. We walked, and Hugh told me about the blackouts that had followed Jacobs's electrical treatment for deafness. They were brief, but frequent in the first couple of days, and there was no actual sense of unconsciousness. He would just find himself in a different place and discover that 5 minutes had gone by, or 10. On 2 occasions, it happened while he and Jacobs were loading equipment and second-hand sales goods into an old plumbing supply panel truck Jacobs had borrowed from someone. Maybe from another of his miracle cures, although if that was the case, Hugh never found out. The Rev was closed-mouthed about such things.
I asked him what happened during those times, and he said nothing, that we just went on moving stuff and conversing like normal.
Did you believe him?
I did, at the time. Now, I don't know.
One night, Hugh said, this would have been 5 or 6 days post-treatment, he was sitting in his Fleabag hotel room's one chair, reading a book, and suddenly found himself standing in the corner, facing the wall. "Were you saying anything?" I asked, thinking something happened, something, something, something.
"No," he said. "But..."
"But what?" He shook his head at the memory.
"I had taken off my pants and then put my sneakers back on. I was just standing there in my jockey shorts and Reeboks. Crazy, huh?"
"Muy loco," I said. "How long did these mini lapses go on?"
"Oh, the second weeks are only a couple. By the third week, they were gone. But there was something else that lasted longer. Something with my eyes. These events. The prismatics. I don't know what else to call them. They happened maybe a dozen times over the next 5 years. Nothing at all since then."
We had reached the studio. Mookie was waiting for us, his Broncos Kimmy cap turned around backward, making him look like the world's oldest skateboarder. "The band's in there. They're practicing." He lowered his voice.
"Dudes, they're fucking horrible."
"Tell them we'll be starting late," I said. "We'll give them extra time on the other end to make up for it." Mookie looked from Hugh to me and then back to Hugh, taking the emotional temperature.
"Hey, nobody's going to get fired, are they?"
"Not unless you leave the soundboard on again," Hugh said. "Now get in there and let the adults talk."
Mookie saluted and went inside. Hugh turned back to me.
"The prismatics were much weirder than the blackouts. I don't really know how to describe them. Like the man said, you had to be there."
"Try."
"I always knew when it was going to happen. I was going along through my day, you know, business as usual, and then my vision would seem to sharpen."
"Like your hearing after the treatment?" He shook his head.
"No, that was real. My ears are still better now than they ever were before the Rev's treatment, and I know a hearing test would prove it, although I've never bothered to get one. No, the vision thing was, you know how epileptics can tell a seizure is coming by tingling in their wrists or some phantom smell?
Precursors."
"Right. That sense I got of my vision sharpening was a precursor. What happened after was color.
Color.
The world filled with all reds, blues, and greens at the edges of things. And the colors would shift back and forth. It was like looking through a prism, but one that magnified things at the same time it was shattering them into pieces. He patted his forehead, a gentle gesture of frustration. That's as close as I can get. And during the 30 or 40 seconds it was happening, it was as if I could almost look through the world, and there was another world right behind it, a realer world. He looked at me soberly. Those were the prismatics. I've never talked about them to anyone until today. They scared the hell out of me. You never even told the Rev? Well, I would have. But he was already gone the first time it happened. No big goodbyes. Just a note saying he had a business opportunity in Joplin. This was 6 months or so after the miracle cure, and I was back in here in Nederland. The prismatics, they were beautiful in a way I could never describe, but I hope they never come back. Because if that other world is really there, I don't want to see it. And if it's in my mind, I want it to stay there. Mookie came out.
There you ought to go, Jamie. I'll roll some sound if you want. I sure can't fuck it up because these guys make the Dead Milkman sound like the Beatles.
That might be, but they paid cash for their session. No, I'll be right in. Tell them 2 more minutes. He disappeared.
So, Hugh said, you got mine, but I didn't get yours, and I still want it.
I've got an hour around 9 tonight. I'll come up to the big house and tell you then. It won't take long. My story's basically the same as yours. Treatment, cure, after effects that attenuated, then passed completely. Not quite true. But I had a session to record.
No prismatics?
Nope. Other stuff. Tourette's without the swearing, for one thing. I decided I'd keep the dreams of dead family members to myself, at least for the time being. Maybe they were my glimpses of Hugh's other world.
We ought to go see him. Hugh gripped my arm. We really ought to.
I think you're right.
But no big reunion dinner, okay? I don't even want to talk to him. Just observe.
Fine, I said and looked down at his hand. Now let go of me before you leave a bruise. I have to record some music. He let go. I went into the studio, and the sound of some local punk band playing Leather Jacket and Safety Pin stuff the Ramones did a lot better back in the 70s. When I looked back over my shoulder, Hugh was still standing there, looking at the mountains. The world beyond the world, I thought, then put it out of my mind, or tried to, and went to work. I didn't break down and get a laptop of my own for another year, but there was plenty of computing power in Studios 1 and 2. By 2008, we were recording almost everything with Mac programs, and when I got a break around 5, I Googled C. Danny Jacobs and found thousands of references. Apparently, I'd missed quite a lot since C. Danny first appeared on the national scene 10 years before. But I didn't blame myself. I'm not much of a TV watcher. My interest in popular culture revolved around music, and my church-going days were long over. No wonder I had missed the preacher, his Wikipedia entry called The 21st Century Oral Roberts. He had no megachurch, but his weekly Hour of Healing Gospel Power was telecast from coast to coast on high cable channels where the buy-in price was low and the return in love offerings was presumably high. The shows were taped at his old-time tent revivals, which crisscrossed most of the country, steering clear of the East Coast, where people were presumably a bit less credulous. In pictures taken over the years, I watched Jacobs grow older and grayer, but the look in his eyes never changed, fanatical and somehow wounded. A week or so before Hugh and I made our trip to see Jacobs in his native environment, I called Georgia Donlan and asked if I could have her daughter's number, the one who was studying computers at Colorado University. The daughter's name was Brianna. Bria and I had an extremely interesting conversation. Chapter 8. Tent Show. It was 70 miles from Nederland to the Norris County Fairgrounds, which gave Hugh and me plenty of time to talk. But we said almost nothing until we were east of Denver, just sat and looked at the scenery. Except for the ever-present smog line over Arvada, it was a perfect late summer day. Then Hugh snapped off the radio, which had been playing a steady stream of oldies on KXKL, and said, "Did your brother Conrad have any lingering effects after the Rev fixed up his laryngitis, or whatever it was?" "No, but that's not surprising. Jacob said the cure was bogus, a placebo. And I always thought he was telling the truth. Probably he was. That was early days for him, remember, when his idea of a big project was getting better TV reception. Con's mind just needed permission to get better."
"Belief is powerful," Hugh agreed. "So is faith. Look at all the groups and solo acts we have lining up to make CDs, even though hardly anybody buys them anymore. Have you done any research on C. Danny Jacobs?"
"Plenty. George's daughter is helping me with that."
"Well, I've done some myself. And I'll bet plenty of his cures are like your brother's. People with psychosomatic illnesses who decide they're healed when Pastor Danny touches them with his magic God rings."
"That might be true. But after watching Jacobs operate at the Tulsa Fairgrounds, I was sure he had learned the real secret of building a tip. You had to give the rubes at least a little steak to go with the sizzle. Women declaring their migraines were gone, and men exclaiming their sciatica had departed, were all very well. But stuff like that wasn't very visual. They weren't portraits and lightning, you might say. There were at least 24 debunking websites about him, including one called C. Danny Charles, Faith's Fraud. Hundreds of people had posted to these sites, claiming the cancerous tumors Pastor Danny removed were pig's livers or goat guts. Although cameras carried by audience members were forbidden at C. Danny's services, and a film was confiscated if one of the ushers glimpsed someone taking snaps, plenty of photos had leaked out just the same. Many of them seemed to actually complement the official videos posted on C. Danny's website. In others, however, the glistening goop in Pastor Danny's hands certainly did look a lot like goat guts. My guess was that the tumors were fake. That part of the show just smelled too carny from carny to be anything else. But it didn't mean everything Jacobs was doing was fake. Here were two men in a boat-sized Lincoln Continental who could testify to that.
"You had sleepwalking and involuntary movements," Hugh said, "which, according to WebMD, is called myoclonus, transient in your case. Also, the need to poke things into yourself, as if down deep you still wanted to be riding the needle."
"All true."
"I had blackouts where I talked and moved around, like booze blackouts, only without the booze."
"And the prismatics," I said.
"Uh-huh. Then there's the girl from Tulsa you told me about, the one who stole the earrings. World's ballsiest smash and grab.
She thought they belonged to her because they were in the picture he took of her. I bet she was rolling around boutiques in Tulsa looking for that dress, too."
"Did she remember breaking into the display case?"
I shook my head. I was long gone from Tulsa by the time Kathy Morris came up for trial. But Brianna Donlan had found a brief item about her online. The Morris girl claimed to remember nothing, and the judge believed her. He ordered a psychological evaluation and released her into the custody of her parents. After that, she dropped out of sight. Hugh was quiet for a while. so was I. We watched the road unroll. Now that we were out of the mountains, it ran straight as a string all the way to the horizon. At last he said, "What's it for, Jamie?"
"Money." He works the funnel cake circuit for a few years, and one day says, "This is chicken feed. Why don't I start a healing ministry and go for the really big bucks?"
Maybe. But I never got the idea that Charlie Jacobs cared about the big bucks. He doesn't care about God anymore either, unless he's done a 360 from when he blew up his ministry in my little town. And I didn't see any sign of religious feeling when I was in Tulsa. He cared about his wife and son. That book of photographs I found in his RV was so well-thumbed it was just about falling apart. And I'm sure he still cares about his experiments. When it comes to his secret electricity, he's like Mr. Toad with his motor car.
I don't follow.
Obsessed. If I had to guess, I'd say he needs money to keep moving forward with his various experiments, more than he could make running a midway shy.
So healing's not the end point. That's not the goal.
I couldn't be sure, but I didn't think healing was the goal. Running a revival biz was undoubtedly a cynical jape at the religion he had rejected, as well as a way to turn a great many fast bucks via love offerings. But Jacobs hadn't healed me for the money. That had been a plain old Christian hand up from a guy who had been able to reject the label, but not the two basic tenets of Jesus's ministry, charity and mercy. "I don't know where he's headed," I said.
"Do you think he does?"
"I do, actually."
"This secret electricity, I wonder if he even knows what it is."
I wondered if he even cared, which was a scary thought. The Norris County Fair ran during the last half of September. I had been there with a lady friend a couple of years before, and it was a big one. This being June, the fairgrounds were deserted except for a single huge canvas tent. Fittingly enough, it was where the cheesiest end of the midway would be when the fair was up and running. The rigged gambling shies and the titty shows. The large parking lots were filled with cars and pickup trucks, many of them old beaters with bumper stickers saying things like, "Jesus died for me, I'll live for him." Crowning the tent, probably bolted to the center pole, was a huge electric cross and rising barber pole stripes of red, white, and blue. From inside came the sound of an electrified gospel combo and the rhythmic clapping of the audience. People were still streaming in. The majority were graying, but there were plenty of younger folks, too.
"They sound like they're having a good time," Hugh said.
"Yeah, Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show." With a cool wind blowing in from the plains, it was a comfortable 65 outside the tent, but it had to be 20 degrees warmer inside. I saw farmers in bib overalls and elderly wives with flushed, happy faces. I saw men in suits and women in dressy dresses, as if they had come here directly from their office jobs in Denver. There was a contingent of Chicano ranch hands in jeans and work shirts, some displaying what looked like prison tats below their rolled-up sleeves. I even saw a few inked teardrops. Down front was the wheelchair brigade. The six-piece band was swaying and laying down hot licks. In front of them, stepping exuberantly from side to side in voluminous burgundy choir robes, were half a dozen hefty chicks, Davina Robinson and the Gospel Robins. They flashed white teeth and brown faces and clapped their hands over their heads. Davina herself danced forward, cordless mic in hand, gave out a musical cry that sounded like Aretha in her prime, and launched into song. "I got Jesus in my heart. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I'm going up to glory. So can you. I could go today because he washed my sins away. I got Jesus in my heart. Yes, I do." She urged the faithful to join in, which they did with a will. Hugh and I took our places at the back, because by now the tent, which probably held upwards of 1,000, was SRO. Q leaned toward me and shouted in my ear,
Dig the pipes. She's great.
I nodded and began clapping along. There were 5 verses with plenty of yes I do's, and by the time Davina finished, sweat was rolling down her face and even the wheelchair people were into it. She climaxed with another Aretha-style ululation, mic held high. The organist and lead guitarist held that last chord for dear life. When they finally let go, she shouted, "Give me a hallelujah, you beautiful people." They did.
"And now give it to me like you know God's love."
They gave it to her like they knew God's love. Satisfied on that score, she asked if they were ready for some Al Stamper. They let her know they were more than ready. The band brought it down to something slow and slinky. The audience took their seats in rows of folding chairs. A bald black man strode briskly on stage, carrying his 300-plus pounds with delicious ease. Hugh leaned in close, able to speak more quietly now.
"He used to be with the Volites in the 70s. Skinny as a rail back then, and had an afro big enough to hide a coffee table in. I thought he was fucking dead. All the coke he snorted, he should be."
Stamper immediately confirmed this.
"I was a big sinner," he confided to the audience. "Now, praise God, I am just a big eater."
They laughed. He laughed with them, then grew serious again.
"I was saved by the grace of Jesus and healed of my addictions by Pastor Danny Jacobs. Now, some of you might remember the secular songs I did with the Volites, and some fewer of you might remember the ones I did when I went out on my own. I'm singing different tunes these days, all those God-sent tunes I once rejected."
"Praise Jesus!"
someone shouted from the audience.
"That's right, brother. Praise his name, and that's what I'm going to do right now."
He launched into "Let the Lower Lights Be Burning," a hymn I remembered well from my childhood, and a voice so deep and true it made my throat ache. By the time he finished, most of the faithful were singing along, their eyes shining. He did 2 more songs, the melody and backbeat of the second sounding suspiciously like Al Green's "Let's Stay Together," then reintroduced the Gospel Robins. They sang, he sang with them. They made a joyous noise unto the Lord and whipped that congregation into a good God come to Jesus frenzy. As the crowd stood, clapping themselves red-handed, the lights in the tent went down, except for a bright white spot at stage left, which was where C. Danny Jacobs entered. It was my Charlie, all right, and Hugh's Rev, but how he had changed since I saw him last. His voluminous black coat, similar to the one Johnny Cash wore on stage, partially concealed how thin he'd grown, but his gaunt face tattled the truth. There were other truths there as well. I think most people who have suffered great losses in their lives, great tragedies, come to a crossroads. Maybe not right then, but when the shock wears off. It may be months later, it may be years. They either expand as a result of their experience, or they contract. If that sounds new agey, and I suppose it does, I don't apologize. I know what I'm talking about. Charles Jacobs had contracted. His mouth was a pale line. His blue eyes blazed, but they were caught in nets of wrinkles and looked smaller, shielded somehow. The cheerful young man who had helped me make caves in Skull Mountain when I was 6, the man who had listened with such kindliness when I told him how Khan had gone mute, that man now looked like an old-time New England schoolmaster about to birch a recalcitrant pupil. Then he smiled, and I could at least hope the young guy who had befriended me was still somewhere inside this carny show gospel shouter. That smile lit up his whole face. The crowd applauded, partly out of relief, I think. He raised his hands, then lowered them with the palms down.
"Sit, brothers and sisters. Sit, boys and girls. Let us take fellowship one with the other."
They sat in a great, rustling swoosh, The tent grew quiet. Every eye was upon him. I bring you good news that you've heard before. God loves you. Yes, every one of you, those who've lived upright lives and those who are neck-deep in sin. He so loved you that he gave his only begotten Son, John 3:16. On the eve of his crucifixion, his Son prayed that you should be kept from evil, John 17:15. When God corrects, when he gives us burdens and afflictions, he does so in love, Acts 17:11. And can he not lift those burdens and afflictions in that same spirit of love?
Yes, praise God,
came an exultant shout from the wheelchair row. I stand before you, a wanderer on the face of America, and a vessel of God's love. Will you accept me as I accept you? They shouted they would. Sweat was rolling down my face and Hugh's, and the faces of those on either side of us. But Jacob's face was dry and shining, although the spotlight he stood in had to make the air around him even hotter. Add to that the black coat. Once I was married, and had a little boy, he said. There was a terrible accident, and they drowned. It was like a splash of cold water in my face. Here was a lie when there was no reason to lie. At least none that I could see. The audience murmured, almost moaned. Many of the women were crying, and a few of the men as well. I turned my face from God then, and cursed him in my heart. I wandered in the wilderness. Oh, it was New York and Chicago and Tulsa and Joplin and Dallas and Tijuana. It was Portland, Maine and Portland, Oregon, but it was all the same. All the wilderness. I wandered from God, but I never wandered from the memory of my wife and my little boy. I put off the teachings of Jesus, but I never put off this. He raised his left hand, displaying a gold band that seemed too wide and thick to be an ordinary wedding ring. I was tempted by women. Of course I was. I'm a man. And Potiphar's wife is always among us. But I stayed true.
Praise God,
a woman shouted. One who probably thought she'd know a Potiphar's wife if she ever saw that hot box harlot in matron's clothing. And then one day, after refusing such a temptation that was unusually severe, unusually seductive, I had a revelation from God. Even as did Saul on the road to Damascus.
God's word,
a man shouted, lifting his hands heavenward, top of the tent word, at least.
God told me I had work, and that my work would be to lift the burdens and afflictions of others.
He came to me in a dream and told me to put on another ring. One that would signify my marriage to the teachings of God through his holy word and the teachings of his Son, Jesus Christ. I was in Phoenix then, working in a godless carnival show, and God told me to walk into the desert without food and water, like any Old Testament pilgrim on the face of the land. He told me that in the wilderness I would find the ring of my second and final marriage. He told me if I remained true to that marriage, I would do great good and be reunited with my wife and son in heaven, and our true marriage would be reconsecrated by his holy throne and in his holy light. There were more cries and ejaculations. A woman in a trim business suit, tan hose, and stylish low heels fell into the aisle. Began to testify in a language that seemed solely comprised of vowels. The man with her, husband or boyfriend, knelt beside her, pillowing her head with his hand, smiling tenderly, urging her on. He doesn't believe a word of it, I said. I was astounded. Every word is a lie. They must see that. But they didn't. And Hugh didn't hear me. He was staring, transfixed. The tent was a tumult of gladness. Jacob's voice rising above it, pounding through the hosannas by the grace of electricity and a cordless mic.
All day I walked. I found food someone had left in a trash bin at a rest area and ate it. I found a half bottle of Coca-Cola beside the trail and drank it. And then God told me to leave the path. And although it was coming on to dark by then, and better trail hands than me have died in that desert, I did as he said.
Must have been all the way out in the suburbs by then, I thought. Maybe all the way to North Scottsdale, where the rich folks live.
The night was dark with clouds, not a star to be seen. But just after midnight, those clouds parted and a ray of moonlight shone down on a pile of rocks. I went to them, and beneath it, I found this.
He held up his right hand. On the third finger was another thick gold band. The audience burst into applause and hallelujahs. I kept trying to make sense of it and kept coming up short. Here were people who routinely used their computers to stay in touch with their friends and get the news of the day, people who took weather satellites and lung transplants for granted, people who expected to live lives 30 and 40 years longer than those of their great-grandparents. Here they were, falling for a story that made Santa and the Tooth Fairy look like gritty realism. He was feeding them shit, and they were loving it. I had the dismaying idea that he was loving it, too, and that was worse. This was not the man I'd known in Harlow, or the one who'd taken me in that night in Tulsa. Although when I thought of how he had treated Kathy Morse's bewildered and broken-hearted farmer father, I had to admit, this man had been on the way even then. I don't know if he hates these people, I thought, but he holds them in contempt. Or maybe not. Maybe he just didn't care, except for what was in the collection basket at the end of the show, that was. Meanwhile, he was continuing his testimony. The band had begun to play as he spoke, whipping the crowd up even further. The gospel robins were swaying and clapping, and the audience joined in. Jacobs talked about his first hesitant healings with the rings of his two marriages, the secular and the sacred, about his realization that God wanted him to bring his message of love and healing to a wider audience, his repeated declarations, knee-bound and agonized, that he wasn't worthy, God replying that he never would have endowed him with the rings if that were true. Jacobs made a sound as if he and God had had long conversations about these matters in some celestial smoking room, perhaps puffing pipes and looking out at the rolling hills of heaven. I hated the way he looked now. That narrow schoolmaster's face and the blue glare of his eyes. I hated the black coat, too. Carnies called that kind of coat a gag jacket. I had learned as much working Jacob's portraits and lightning gaff at Bell's Amusement Park.
"Join me in prayer, won't you?" Jacobs asked, and fell to his knees with what looked like a brief squint of pain.
"Rheumatism? Arthritis? Pastor Danny, heal thyself," I thought. The congregation went to its knees in another vast swoosh of clothes and exalted murmurs. Those of us standing at the back of the tent did likewise. I almost resisted. Even to a lapsed Methodist like me, this deal reeked of showbiz blasphemy. But the last thing I wanted was to attract his notice, as I had in Tulsa. "He saved your life," I thought. "You don't want to forget that." True. And the years since had been good years. I closed my eyes, not in prayer, but confusion. I wished I hadn't come, but there had really been no choice. Not for the first time, I wished I hadn't asked Georgia Donlin to put me in touch with her computer-savvy daughter. Too late now. Pastor Danny prayed for those present. He prayed for the shut-ins who wanted to be here with them but could not be. He prayed for the men and women of goodwill. He prayed for the United States of America, and that God would imbue her leaders with his wisdom. Then he got down to business, praying for God to work healing through his hands and holy rings as it accorded with his will, and the band played on. Are there those among you who would be healed? He asked, struggling to his feet with another grimace. Al Stamper started to come forward to assist him, but Jacobs waved the ex-soul singer back. Are there those among you with heavy burdens that they would lay down and afflictions they would be free of? The congregation agreed, and loudly, that these things were so. The wheelchair people and the chronics in the first two rows were staring raptly. So were those in the rows behind, many of them haggard and looking sick unto death. There were bandages and disfigurements and oxygen masks and withered limbs and braces. There were those who twitched and rocked helplessly as their CP-impaired brains did pissed-off jigs inside their skulls. Davina and the Gospel Robins began to sing, Jesus says come forth, as softly as a spring wind, blowing off the desert. Ushers in pressed jeans, white shirts, and green vests appeared like magic. Some began organizing a line down the center aisle of those hoping to be healed. Other green vests, many others, circulated in the crowd with wicker collection baskets so big they looked like panniers. I heard the clink of coins, but it was scattered and sporadic. Most of these people were tossing in folding green, what carnies call the kick. The woman who had been speaking in tongues was being helped back to her folding chair by her boyfriend or husband. Her hair hung loose around her flushed, exalted face, and her suit jacket was smeared with dirt. I felt smeared with dirt myself, but now we'd gotten to what I really wanted to see. From my pocket, I pulled a notebook and a Bic. It already held several entries, some from my own research, more courtesy of Brianna Donlan.
What are you doing?
Hugh asked me in a low voice. I shook my head. The healing was about to begin, and I had watched enough videos on Pastor Danny's website to know how it went. This is old school, Bri had said after watching several of the videos herself. A woman in a wheelchair rolled forward. Jacobs asked for her name and held the microphone to her lips. In a trembling voice, she declared herself to be Rowena Mintor, a schoolteacher who'd come all the way from Des Moines. She had terrible arthritis and could no longer walk. I wrote her name in my notebook beneath that of Mabel Jurgens, healed of a spinal cord injury a month ago in Albuquerque. Jacobs dropped the mic into an outside pocket of his gag jacket and grasped her head in his hands, pressing the rings to her temples and her face to his chest. He closed his eyes. His lips moved in silent prayer, or the words to "Here we go round the mulberry bush," for all I knew. Suddenly she jerked. Her hands flew up to either side and flapped like white birds. She stared into Jacob's face, her eyes wide either with astonishment or the aftermath of a jolt of electricity. Then she stood up. The crowd bellowed alleluias. As she embraced Jacobs and covered his cheeks with kisses, several men tossed their hats in the air, a thing I'd seen in movies but never in real life. Jacobs grasped her shoulders, turned her toward the audience, all of them agog, not excluding me, and dipped for his microphone with the practiced smoothness of an old Midway showy.
Walk to your husband, Rowena. Jacobs thundered into the mic. Walk to him and praise Jesus with every step. Praise God with every step. Praise his holy name.
She tottered to her husband, holding her arms out to keep her balance and weeping. An usher in a green vest pushed her wheelchair close behind her in case her legs gave way. But they didn't. It went on for an hour. The music never stopped, nor did the ushers with the deep offering baskets. Jacobs didn't heal everybody, but I can tell you that his collection crew stripped those rubes right down to their no-doubt maxed-out credit cards. Many of the wheelchair brigade were unable to rise after being touched by the holy rings, but half a dozen of them did. I wrote down all the names, crossing out those who seemed as fucked over after Jacobs' healing touch as before. There was a woman with cataracts who declared she could see, and under the bright lights, the milky glaze really did appear to have left her eyes. A crooked arm was made straight. A wailing baby with some sort of heart defect stopped crying as if a switch had been turned off. A man who approached on Canadian crutches, his head bent, tore off the neck brace he was wearing and cast the crutches aside. A woman suffering from advanced COPD dropped her oxygen mask. She declared that she could breathe freely, and the weight on her chest was gone. Many of the cures were impossible to quantify, and it was very possible some were plants. The man with the ulcers who declared his stomach pain was gone for the first time in 3 years, for instance. Or the woman with diabetes, one leg amputated below the knee, who said she could feel her hands and remaining toes again. A couple of chronic migraine sufferers who testified that their pain was gone, praise God, all gone. I wrote the names down anyway, and when they gave them, the towns and states they hailed from. Bree Donlan was good. She had gotten interested in the project, and I wanted to give her as much to work with as possible. Jacobs only removed one tumor that night, and that fellow's name I didn't even consider writing down, because I saw one of Jacobs' hands dart into the gag jacket before he applied his magic rings. What he displayed to the gasping, rapturous audience looked suspiciously like supermarket calf's liver to me. He gave it to one of the green vests, who popped it into a jar and hustled it out of sight post-haste. At last, Jacobs declared the healing touch exhausted for the night. I don't know about that, but he certainly looked exhausted, done to death, in fact. His face was still dry, but the front of his shirt was sticking to his chest. When he stepped back from the reluctantly dispersing faithful who hadn't gotten a chance, many would undoubtedly follow him to his next revival meeting. He stumbled. Al Stamper was there to grab him, and this time Jacobs accepted the help. "Let us pray," Jacobs said. He was having a hard time catching his breath, and I couldn't help worrying that he might faint or go into cardiac arrest right there. "Let us offer our thanks to God as we offer our burdens to Him." After that, brothers and sisters, Al and Davina and the Gospel Robins will see us out in song. This time, he didn't attempt kneeling, but the congregation did, including a few who had probably never expected to kneel again in their earthly lives. There was that airy swoosh of clothes, and it almost covered the gagging noises from beside me. I turned just in time to see the back of Hugh's plaid shirt disappearing between the flaps at the entrance to the tent. I found him standing beneath a pole light 15 feet away, bent double and grasping his knees. The night had cooled considerably, and the puddle between his feet was steaming lightly. As I approached, his body heaved and the puddle grew larger. When I touched his arm, he jerked and stumbled, almost falling into his own vomit, which would have made for a fragrant ride home. The panicky gaze he turned on me was that of an animal caught in a forest fire. Then he relaxed and straightened up, pulling an old-fashioned rancher's bandana from his back pocket. He wiped his mouth with it. His hand was trembling. His face was dead white. Some of that was undoubtedly because of the harsh glare thrown by the pole light, but not all. "Sorry, Jamie. You startled me." I noticed.
"It was the heat, I guess. Let's get out of here. What do you say? Beat the crowd."
He started walking toward the Lincoln. I touched his elbow. He pulled away. Except that's not quite right. He shied away. What was it, really? He didn't answer at first, just kept walking toward the far side of the lot, where his Detroit cabin cruiser was parked. I walked beside him. He reached the car and put his hand on the dew-misted hood, as if for comfort.
"It was a prismatic.
The first one in a long, long time. I felt it coming on while he was healing that last one. The guy who said he was paralyzed from the waist down in a car accident. When he got up from his chair, everything went sharp. Everything went clear, you know?" I didn't, but I nodded as if I did. From behind us, the congregation was clapping joyously and singing, "How I Love My Jesus," at the top of its lungs. Then, when the Rev started to pray, The colors.
He looked at me, his mouth trembling. He looked 20 years older.
They were ever so much brighter. They shattered everything.
He reached out and grasped my shirt hard enough to tear off two of the buttons. It was the grip of a drowning man. His eyes were huge and horrified.
Then all those fragments came together again, but the colors didn't go away. They danced and twisted like the aurora borealis on a winter night. In a people. They weren't people anymore.
What were they, Hugh?
Ants, he whispered. Huge ants. The kind that must only live in tropical forests. Brown ones and black ones and red ones. They were looking at him with dead eyes, and that poison they used, formic acid, was dripping from their mouths.
He drew a long, ragged breath.
If I ever see anything like that again, I'll kill myself.
It's gone, though, right?
Yes, gone. Thank God.
He dragged his keys from his pocket and dropped them in the dirt. I picked them up. I'll drive us back.
Sure. You do that.
He started toward the passenger seat, then looked at me.
You too, Jamie. I turned to you and I was standing next to a huge ant. You turned. You looked at me.
Hugh, I didn't. I barely saw you going out. He seemed not to hear.
You turned. You looked at me. And I think you tried to smile. There were colors all around you, but your eyes were dead, like all the rest. And your mouth was full of poison.